The most general assumption here in this country, anyhow, is that there is and should be preserved very clearly a separation of church and state. So let me just put here church, state. And it is usually assumed that there is a very clear boundary between the two, and that must be maintained even then when it comes to court decisions and so on. So you would say that the church has to do with the spiritual realm, and that the state would have to do with the secular realm. You could say, well, the church has to do with the ecclesiastical order, and the state has to do with the social order. Or you could put it in a different way, say, well, the church leads with people in their private order, while the state has to do with people in their public order. You could say that the state has to do with the physical needs of human beings, you could say with their bodies, while the church has to do with spiritual needs and therefore with their soul. You might listen that the church uses as an instrument the word. That's the power of the church, preaching the word, while the state uses, you could say, uses in the traditional old word, the sword. And I'm giving the idea of the coercive power which the church, which the state exercises in enforcing the law, which will be way of to put as a for the state, while the church would be preaching the gospel. And always you will have to keep this neatly separated. That's the basic assumption. If the state, for example, would use the gospel, that would not work, because not everybody is a Christian, is one of the Lutheran arguments given sometimes in support to this view, but because of the human nature and fallen in sin and so on, the law has to be the tool used by the state, while the church then preaches the gospel. Therefore, you could say the church preaches forgiveness, while the state or the judicial system and so on has to work with punishment of evil. And you could say that the church preaches, transmits love, while the state has repression of evil and not love and forgiveness. Well, you see, we could actually continue the list. That deep is actually our assumption of separation. It seems to be very clear, and it seems to work all right, and that's the way it goes. So, just running through the list again. Well, secular order, public order, and the social order, the body, the physical needs of people, while on the side of the church, you would have the spiritual dimension of human beings, and in organizing somewhat social way, only the life of the church itself would belong to that side, but even then, many people would argue, well, that's a piece of the social order which actually would be on the other side. So at the best, they would say the organization of the church would belong to the side of the church and the spiritual realm. Then the division of public and private is very, very, very strong. So the church has a word to say about the private life of people and the morality and how they should live and relate within the family, but not in relation to social issues. That's not the task of the church, is assumed in this model. That is a public thing. The church does not speak to that. That has to be regulated on the other side, the other column, by the state. And therefore also the state takes care of the body and the physical needs of people, while the church is concerned about the soul of people and eternal life of people, which then might be declared as much more important and ultimately the only important thing, while all the social order and the physical needs of people to be met and so on, that's very provisional, that's transitory, and in relation to the other one, which will be the important thing. And since the state has as a task to take care of that, the church should concentrate exclusively, perhaps, on the other one. And again, while you're just running along the list again, church only has the word, no other instruments to enforce. It relies on the preaching and of the free acceptance by people of what is preached, while the state has laws and has means to enforce the law and has a police and has an army, and so all under the word of the sword, the traditional word to give a picture of all this force and power that the state will have and the church will not have and should not have. And, well, law and gospel, I mentioned that already when putting the words on the blackboard. When we preach, for example, as Lutherans, we preach the Ten Commandments, or the second part of the Ten Commandments, not committing robbery and so on. There is a dimension of bringing up to the consciousness that we are sinful persons and that we need the gospel, the free gospel. So we move to that side again. Why? When the state gets involved with issues of robbery, we'll use the means of enforcing law and prosecuting those who don't respect the law, and the state will then be happy if people respect that law outwardly, externally, while the church in its preaching is never happy with only an external observance of the law, but digs deeper into the interior of the people. You might have not infringed in action a given law, but might have thought about it, but only because you are kind of scared of the consequences under the law, you might not have done it. So the church digs in the preaching much deeper, and then the only relief is God's forgiveness, God's grace, and the good news of the gospel, while the state will look for enforcing of the law in an external way, and if not, then punish those who have not respected the law. And therefore there is a degree of repression, of coercive power by the state, which will limit under the limits of the law what people can do, while that's not the instrument for the church, and by God, then it's actually love and forgiveness. So it sounds very good, very clear distinctions, and each side would know what to do. And if each one of the sides would stick to the proper realm, it seems that everything would work all right. Let me pursue a step further to understand the kind of values and which are in this concept and the views that are connected with it. And let me suggest first that for Christians who adopt that kind of model, there are two variants which seem to be very contradictory, and we might then raise the question whether they are that contradictory. The first variant would be a kind of a demonization of the state, of all that. Quite a few Christians and church bodies and Christian movements kind of come out of the assumption that everything in the social realm, public order, is evil. I've heard very often that the kind of reasoning of that Christians have to be kind of rescued out of that realm because it is evil. All of this is part of the fallen world. We were still under the original plan of God with creation. We would not need anything of this. Everything would be working all right just as a consequence of this first column. So all of that is actually a sign of the fallen world, and it's evil, it's bad, so Christians should be rescued out of it and be happy with this column, which will be the decisive one, which will lead us into a meaningful life here and definitely into eternal life. Therefore, Christians should not get involved in social, political issues, because that belongs to the evil realm. And they should not, some movements will then say they should not get involved at all in that, because any participation in it, you are participating in that evil which is present in the social and political realm. And the only thing to do is really is to step aside. We know from church history that some movements were as radical in that they really moved as radical as possible out of the world into the desert. There was one monk who actually lived for 40 years on the top of a stone column because he didn't want to be in contact with the evil world. And so being outside, it seemed that would be a perfect way of living in this fallen world without contact. We do know from Luther, for example, that he also tried that kind of movement, and he found out that he was carrying the world in himself, so he found it within himself and then kind of moved back into the world with a discipline of Christian life into the world. Well, but that's moving ahead a little bit already. But one very common movement feature is that of saying everything is evil, so you just step out and you don't get involved in that. Politics is something dirty, I have heard very much. Something dirty, so you cannot be involved in it. So the assumption that this is the good side and that is the evil side, that is fallen world and here is the community of the redeemed, and so this is perfect and the other one is evil. That's one version, and in some Protestant movements probably a very tempting one. I think about Latin America, that's very often one of the contents of the preaching of missionaries and one of the content of the preaching of the Pentecostal movement in Latin America too. I don't go into detail now. Well, the other The other variant seems to be at the extreme opposite. It is kind of, let me say, the liberal view of separation of church and state. That liberal view is, on the contrary, very, very optimistic. That's a good model because it's good, and the good is done here and the good is done there. So that works perfectly. That's all right. And if you we just separate, as I tried to develop a little bit, separate the two realms, and then leave it to the authorities who are in charge of it, so that will work perfectly. That's good on both sides, a very optimistic view of the human beings, of society, and you just have to avoid mixing the two. That would bring about problems, but if you separate it neatly, then it will work all right also on that side. We have people who are in charge for that, and if you deal with a social order under the law and so on, and have the instruments to enforce it in society, that's and take care of the public order, that's fine, that's perfect, that's good. So it seems to be the contrary of the other one. Now, I say it seems to be the contrary, and in reality it's not, because if you think a little bit, what consequences has one position and the other, you will come to the conclusion that it's actually the same consequence. Both positions strengthen given realities, whatever they are. Because if you leave out because it's evil, well, you leave it as it is. If you say it's good as it is, well, you also leave it as it is and give support to it. You might perhaps work with a concept of development, of evolution. You eventually might say, well, we can do it even better. But in principle, you would be supporting and say that's good and give the support. So extremely different views. The one saying, well, that's diabolic, that's the evil. The other one saying it's good. But in the consequences, both positions actually give support to the status quo and accept it as it is. Even those who want to get out of it, well, as radically as the one monk on one column, that's actually not possible. So what most people then do is they accept the professional life, and that is a part of the public life, accept that, because they have to make a living somehow and so on, they accept it as something regulated there, and keep the faith and also the criticism that things are evil, keep it as a certain for the private life. You can get your private life out of it. You go on Sunday to church service, attend church service, and then from Monday to Saturday you accept uncritically the public order. And on Sunday again you are nourished for your private consumption. And you might even nurture a view that everything is evil, but actually when you go into the public life you accept it as it is. So that is the I would say a big problem, because you might say it's evil, but how do you change it? You might say it's good, but is it really as good as you are assuming? Don't we have to define the relations between church and state in somewhat different way? That's the kind of question I'm trying to raise. Now, more briefly so, because that's not the big issue in this country, and but just to make a kind of a contrast, let me put brief diagram of the other model, which would be the kind of alliance between church and state. Well, a symbol would be very simple: church plus state. along the history of Christianity, that model has been much more prevailing than this one. This one is a fairly new one. Some people will say it comes out of Reformation. I will try to show tomorrow that that's not the case. This model of separation of church and state is really comes really out of Enlightenment and a liberal movement of the past two and a half centuries, and was not the case in Luther, really. That's my conviction. I'll try to make a point of it tomorrow more. But if you take from the beginning of the fourth century, really, with the Constantinian era starting, up to the Reformation times, but probably even beyond that, the question was church and state, and a very close connection between church and state, even identification sometimes, alliance. So many more centuries had that kind of model, and where both cooperate very decisively with each other. There might be a certain type of question, what does the one do, what does the other one do, but it's very consciously a sort of cooperation of alliance. Those of you who have studied church history know that during the medieval times there were for kind of centuries a kind of struggle then, who is going to dominate over the other. So the question church plus state in reality turns out to be a question of, is it going to be this way, church kind of dominating over the state, or is it going to be this way, the state dominating over the church, the emperor or the pope? And we know that at a certain point the Catholic Church then defined that the Pope had both swords, interesting the word swords, and then two swords, both swords in his hands, which would be the spiritual power and the secular power, and could delegate the secular power to the emperor. So he would crown the emperor. That was the symbol of the church over the state. So the state was actually serving purposes which were wider on the church. The church was universal, had the realm of the church extended into all areas, into all of society, and that is Christendom. That's the project of Christendom, church dominating over the whole society, and the state kind of as an instrument of that. And precisely against that, Luther protested, saying that, and then used quite a few, I'll be talking a little bit more about that, quite a few of the kind of distinctions which we are still present here in the model of separation. But at the same time, Luther did not come out of the vision of Christendom, a Christian society, but wanted to make distinctions within that. We are going to talk about that tomorrow. Well, today you really can't find models anymore of the church dominating the state. You might perhaps try to look outside Christianity to find something which would look similar. In Iran, for example, the Shiite Islamic organization of society seems to be a kind of the state under the religious values, so would be somewhat similar perhaps. But the modern, in Western world at least, and therefore Christian world, the modern version is perhaps more tempting, state over the church. Latin American history was to a great extent that. Portugal and Spain came into Latin America, and the church served. The missionaries were functionaries of the crown. That was the patronage system. We talked about that last week. Some of you were there. So it was a, was church and state as a kind of alliance, but actually the interests of the state were the prevailing ones, and the church was serving and giving a Christian legitimacy to the whole process of conquest and exploitation and so on. That was the system in Latin America. Well, okay, again, we would have to look, try to round up, what are the consequences in of these models? Again, the consequences are that dominant interests, a system that is dominating, is given support. You can take either one of the variants over there again, church and state, state and church, but due to alliance and so on, there might be some tensions and conflicts of power and so on, but in general, this, the idea, the view means we give support to existing system. So we come to a certain point where all four variants, the two ones on separation of church and state, the two ones on alliance of church and state, all of them serve to support existing structures and systems. And that's not a coincidence. We are actually within a whole history of Constantinian tradition, and even when that system was broken to some extent, but Western world is the dominating system around the world, so a great interest in supporting that, and the theology is kind of getting accommodated to that, so that support is given. And we must find a way in which we build into our view and our theological view of relation of church and state much greater tensions than are present in these models. And above all, the question of who God is, what does God want for society, and for whom is it for, asking about the recipients, the people who live under these, both under the church and under the state, or within the church, within the state order, and what are the needs, what are the basic needs of people, and so on. These kinds of questions we have to build into our view of church-state relations and make them actually decisive to get a better model. But as I mentioned, that's just a glimpse into tomorrow. We'll talk a little bit more about that tomorrow. Let me add just a few comments. I'll try to be as brief as possible, which are intended to be a kind of a little bit of a challenging to you as North Americans. Some people have mentioned to me that I've been too polite with you, that I should be challenging you a little bit more. So I try to take that seriously. And I do know that you have the openness to listen to it. This system, church and state separation, is very deep in your tradition and in the convictions of this country and in the system of this country, and I think that has consequences into the way we see society within this country, but then even outside. I think it's a kind of a impression I have that this has consequences even for those people who are not Christians, who are not committed Christians, in the sense of kind of delegating what belongs to the public order to those who are in office in state and so on, and refrain themselves more to the private sector, and then want to have that private sector very well preserved, of course, but otherwise just delegated to to people who are in office. So I think it's a kind of a consequence of this very strict model of church-state separation, which goes well beyond the boundaries of the churches themselves and involves actually all the people. And I think this brings about, I would say, with all the openness that American people might have, brings also some what I would call a naive way of looking into the society and even the world. And where people become very often victims of unconscious prejudices. Let me list some of the points I have in mind. For example, we were talking last week about liberation theology. For many, if not for most, probably most North Americans, just listening to the word liberation, that brings a whole series of associations of what they immediately think it's about and it means, and always under the kind of connotation it's bad. All those associations are bad things. Well, might be revolution, violence, violent revolution, Marxism, communism, Russian totalitarianism, and so on. So when you use the very word liberation, all of these things kind of, I felt that they swing along, and then you have to go into a process of decodifying this and trying to bring about what the intended meaning of the word liberation is. The United States itself is a result of a revolution, but that is a kind of a myth in the past. You cannot talk about revolution today, because you have had your revolution already, and that was a good one, and was the last one, and it's supposed to last, and everybody's supposed to copy it. But if others try to copy it, then it becomes dangerous, because then it's a violent revolution, it's Marxist, it brings the danger of Russian totalitarianism. So also the copying of it is a sort of a myth, which is impossible to, should not be realized. Well, the word Marxism, bring about the word Marxism, many, I suppose most, North Americans have never read anything written by Marx, but when they listen to the word Marxism, they know immediately that's something bad. And it would be even dangerous to read something, so you better not read it. So isn't that in contrast with a alleged freedom of expression and the freedom of bringing about ideas and so on? So I'm not implying, that might be the kind of assumption that is coming up into the minds of some, implying that Marxism is now good and totally good, even worse or so. But I'm trying to say Marxism is something which is very powerful in the world and so on. Shouldn't we be concerned with it and study it and read it and so on? But most North Americans, I have found, they know that Marxism is bad, even if they have never read anything about it. That's something which is beyond what I say of a certain naivety of looking into other realities. A third point would be knowledge of history and geography. I could explain in detail, but just as a symbol, we met a post office clerk who thought that Brazil was a city in India. And when we said it was not in India, it was looking into South Africa. Or the high school teacher who asked one of our daughters, pupil of her, whether Brazil was a country. But we realize geography is not offered at all at high school, the big high school where our children were attending, did not offer that course at all. The whole high school, no course in geography being offered. So American people in that sense are victims of of the system too, but the knowledge of geography and then world history is very, very limited, extremely limited, I would say. How to understand the realities of other peoples, other countries, and so on, if that is the case? A self-sufficient assumption of the system within this country. And along with that goes a great lack of information. We were talking the other day about that. If I recall what we, in 1 year, in St. Paul and Minneapolis, big cities, in the United States, read in the papers in the Twin Cities and saw in the TV about Brazil in the news, there was a sort of a nuclear disaster in one occasion in Brazil. We listened to that news. Then we listened about the floods in Rio de Janeiro, where about by rain and about 200 people died. We heard about a building that was being constructed, and a 16-story building that fell down, and 16 laborers died. That was noticed. We saw a big picture, about a quarter of the page of the newspaper, of a giraffe that was being transported from Sao Paulo to Rio de Janeiro, to the zoo in Rio de Janeiro, and the driver, the truck driver, had a big problem of getting under, overpass of the highway, and the giraffe was too tall, and he was trying to get the giraffe to bend the... That was the biggest news about Brazil we saw. Well, at the same time, in this year, in Brazil, there was a constituent assembly working throughout the year, very decisive questions being discussed about the future of Brazil, and you could drafting a new constitution. There was a deep economic crisis, high inflation in Brazil. There were U.S. sanctions on some of Brazilian exports, on shoes, for example, limiting Brazilian exports of shoes. There was the big debt problem of Brazil. There were negotiations going on with the International Monetary Fund and the U.S. banks. And about these things, we didn't listen anything in the TV news, and perhaps a note or two in the local papers, and we would have to look for some other papers to find news about that. How can Americans really understand the rest of the world if the kind of news they get, the coverage of world events, is that? Well, then the next point I have on my list is politics and economics. If I ask the question separation of church and state, a sacred cow, I think much more accurate would be to ask about the economic system as a sacred cow. You cannot really challenge and talk about the economic system. You might criticize the government, that's acceptable, and perhaps sometimes very much so, and the politicians are in a low esteem by many of the people, and so on, and more news about corruption here and corruption there, and deals and not respecting the law, and so on. So most Americans are very critical of the government, of politicians, and so on, but not about the economic system. And I would see it much more the other way around. I see much more good aspects in political life in the United States than I do really in the economic system. And I think when the United States moves in relations abroad, then also puts the economic above the political aspect. So the words might be democracy and so on, but But the system of government in third world countries, which the United States will support, might be a democratic system, might be a dictatorial system, and so on. It depends on whether the economic interests are being preserved or not. If they are challenged, even under a democratic rule, then the United States will be against that political system and will be in favor of a dictatorial system. But on the other hand, if the economic interests of the United States and corporate America are preserved, well, dictatorial systems might be supported. If that can be that under democratic order, better. But if not, then let's take the other way. Well, okay, I think I might have even a few other points here. Well, poor, let me add this one at least, and then open for discussion. Otherwise, I'll talk the full hour. Poor in the United States. I think the growing number of poor in the United States is helping, is the impression I had, is helping American people to raise these questions to consciousness. I think not only the existence of poor people in the wealthiest nation in the world is raising questions for many Americans, homeless people. Americans treasure very much the home they have, so homeless people, that's something which is challenging. And I think out of that, some other questions might arise. How is it? What about our economic system? How is it related? Because it's not just a coincidence. It must have some logic in the whole system that there are growing number of poor people. So the questions in relation to economic system may come out of that. And then also a better understanding of third world reality and so on. But still, I have the impression that you can go kind of around the fact of poverty in the United States and kind of avoid it, not see it. Being in St. Paul and Minneapolis, everything is so well organized, it runs so well, the good highways, you take your car, you go somewhere, you don't have to walk around where the people are, the poor people are living and so on. You can kind of avoid it. But nevertheless, it's coming somewhat to the consciousness of Americans. But still, when you go into public life and office and so on, it's kind of strange that, let me put it that way, that candidate that talks about poverty and so on, even surprising everybody suddenly, oh, so many people are interested about poverty. Well, it's a good sign, I would say. But then the kind of general assumption that you cannot win election with that. You cannot even be on the ballot and so on. Because otherwise you lose the election. Much better to say you are successful, you are rich and wealthy. That seems to be a better qualification for public office, and that's very much to the contrary of what base communities and base communities movement is in Latin America. They are giving value and dignity to the poor people, and knowing that out of their interests and their concern and their community life and their organization, these are the good signs of for the future of a nation. While here it seems still that to be wealthy, to be rich, is a sign of having been successful, and that's the best qualification for public office. Kind of similar also, you bring about, strong leadership. I know to be tough. That seems to be a good qualification. But if you say, well, I'm compassionate, well, that's not the president we want. We want one who knows how to be tough and so on. Doesn't that have a kind of a authoritarian view behind it? Shouldn't be compassion to be the best qualification for the leader of a country? Well, okay, I hope you don't say I have been too gentle. So let me let me open the floor for dialogue in the remaining minutes, and also critical comments on your side and so on. Not only questions, I welcome comments by you.
Talking about compassion, Jimmy Carter is probably one of the most compassionate presidents we've ever had, and he just died politically. Nobody wants it.
People make fun out of him.
Right. He was a good man. He didn't understand government very well at all. But advisors do that. Reagan can't stay awake at his meetings, but he's got advisors. But when it comes to compassion, people will talk about it, but they won't vote for it.
Mm-hmm. Okay, for tape purposes, the example was given of Jimmy Carter being a compassionate person.
Do you think it's possible to encourage corporations to be more responsible and more socially aware and that kind of thing, or do you think that's a lost cause?
Well, I think that only eventually with a very large social pressure and then political control, because I think the big corporations have a rationale of their own. Actually, it's one point. It's a point which I can compliment on the model of separation of church and state. When you are kind of optimistic about the state, or you say this has a rationale of its own, the economic order, the social order, they have a rationale of its own. And if you as a Christian come there with the word of God and so on, that has no place there. There are certain laws, and that works fine. You just have to know the technicalities of it. So there's a basic assumption that's good, and it works for the benefit of everybody. You just have to, the pursuit of happiness for everyone, and you don't take into consideration that somebody might be pursuing his or her happiness at the cost of the happiness of somebody else. No, you can assume that if everybody has the chance of pursuing, then everybody will be happy. And you bring that into the economic system, and I think the corporations are very much under that kind of logic, that it works for the benefit of everybody. Just let it increase, just let it expand, and so on, and everybody will be happy. And but the results, and the third world feels it very much so, and I think the increasing poor in the United States are feeling it, that it's not the welfare of people which is at stake, really. It's the expansion of the whole of this simple machinery, which is at stake, whatever it costs in terms of human beings. And if a factory is more profitable in the third world and people get jobless in the United States, that doesn't matter. Let's move over there. And so I think, and that's the logic of the system. So by their own, they will never get to the point of saying, we have to be more considerate to social needs. I think only with getting aware of that reality and getting people organized and exercising pressure and obliging these corporations to be for the benefit of people and not for the sake of profit as such.
I guess I would have a hope that they could be persuaded it's in their long-term best interest that we have a stable, well-functioning society so that they can function and make money. And if there's a great deal of rebellion and undercurrent of resentment and problems, that can interfere with their long-term well-being and self-interest. And so I guess that's my hope, that they would take a longer view and not just this immediate 3 months bottom line balance sheet look.
Okay. I think there is some potential in the approach you are suggesting of trying to see the problems of the world. They are getting so huge and so on, and what's the potential of unrest, of explosion, and so it's in the long range interest of everybody that we come to a more balanced form of society and also worldwide relations. I would say there is some potential to it, but I think I think that must be a struggle and a reasoning which should be taking place in society as a whole, trying to convince people of that reality. I think it's very hard to get to convince, let's say, well, the top executive people of corporations, and then kind of expect that they will come to an agreement. They are competing with each other and so on, and each one wants needs, really, in the system, needs to make better than the other one, and so on. So only, again, I would say it's a good point, but I think it must have the support of the broad consciousness of people, a wide democratic movement, which will then force that kind of reasoning to become more important than the short-term interests.
I think there are some corporations that'll put 5 or 7 or some percent of their profit into donations or other various causes that are not so directly self-interest. So it might be helpful to try and encourage that movement more universally.
Well, I think anything will help, and I think we should not, because of the great task, we should not lose small possibilities which are given within the system. I think that's correct. But at the same time, those steps should not prevent us of seeing the wider logic. Somebody, okay?
To what extent can capitalism, well, to what extent and in what ways can capitalism be used and help the people of Latin America? In a base Christian community or in a village or in those ways? I've seen, I think most of the people here have seen some of the ways it can hurt. Capitalism can hurt the people. And I'm just interested in how much can it help and in what ways.
That's a tough question. Well, first I would say that, of course, most of Latin American countries, the vast majority of Latin American countries are living under the worldwide capitalistic system. I've heard sometimes the argument, well, Latin America has those problems because it has never experienced capitalism. It's a little bit the reasoning of argument of Michael Novak in his book, Democratic Capitalism. Well, actually, Latin America was never a feudal society in the sense of what was before Luther, for example, because that was feudal society before capitalism came about. Feudal society was a society which was self-sufficient in its own. There was a land tract, and people lived there, and they raised the crops they needed, they made the clothing, and so on. Latin America never was that. From the very beginning, Latin America was serving to other countries which were taking out the resources. That's not the feudal system at all. That's the beginning of capitalistic, mercantile and development. So, but that's not actually your question. Now, if we do live within capitalism, I think there are possibilities of trying to make capitalism as human as possible, and if that is possible to make it very human, well, fine. I think the reality will show. I think capitalism has developed, of course, has developed tremendous knowledges in development of technology, research, and so on. Which also can be put to use for not only for private profit, but can be put to use for the community. So, but then I do think that to come to a world order which will come to grips really with the problem of poverty and so on, we need very, very fundamental, very deep, very profound changes in the economic structure. So I don't have an easy hope of that. My personally feeling is that we need political democratic orders, and then we need political control of economic systems under the criteria of what are the basic needs of people which have to be met. And everything which is superfluous after that comes is of secondary nature, and not of, and you need a political control of that. That's the wider range view that I have. I probably didn't answer well your question because I don't know better.
Yeah, that's maybe that's answer.
Would that be what you're saying, that you, the changes, would you call that socialism then?
Well, you know, I mentioned the word liberation and Marxism and so, but socialism is another of these words that when you use it in this country brings about all those associations which I mentioned to in liberation. And so if I would now answer yes, probably would bring up about these associations, and that would not have been what I would be wanting to communicate if I had said yes. You see, socialism in this country is such a bad word. While in Brazil, even being in within a capitalist world, in the meantime, socialist has become such a cheap word that everybody says it's socialist. Even the most capitalist party and people, they say we are socialists, or we are a socialist democratic party or so. Well, I do think that democracy and socialism in the sense of basic interest in the social needs of people, that is a good combination to look for.
Can you say that there's a country that has a can you point out an example that you feel is better than the democratic capitalism of America? Or not? I mean, that has a democratic government with a better economic system.
Well, I think Nicaragua tried to build such a system, and that was really threatening in Nicaragua, because Nicaragua is a tiny country, 3 million poor people and so on, a threat to the United States. But what was threatening in Nicaragua really is, I think, that they wanted to develop an alternative system to East and West, to the given capitalism and given socialism of Eastern Europe. So we could, probably don't have the time now, bring what are the main points of the Nicaraguan Sandinista idea, which would be non-alignment internationally, neither East nor West. But it's an expression of the will of the third world people to come to a specific order. Second point would be mixed economy. And mixed economy would mean exactly a kind of a political control of very strategic areas, basic needs of the population and so on, and then private economy for the rest, and a deal between the two. That's the idea of mixed economy, not at all a state-run economy for the whole country. That was not the Sandinista project, is not. And the ideological pluralism also was one of the basic points of Sandinism. And I think that is what was really threatening, because better to force, from the point of view of the administration you had in this country, and probably of the economic interest in this country, better to force that tiny country into the Soviet orbit, so that then you have continue to have the clear picture of East and West and good and evil, than to allow that a tiny country like this develop an alternative model which could be attractive for, let's say, suddenly a big country like Brazil. and what that would then represent to the economic interests down there. So I think that is something which I think Nicaragua wanted to build, and under the present circumstances is practically impossible, and I do hope there is still a chance of developing it, but I don't have any example of accomplished reality. I can give examples both in the capitalistic world, let's say Scandinavian countries with putting emphasis also on welfare and basic needs of populations and meeting the needs of poor people. Actually, no poor people really existing in Scandinavia. So, and that's one example within capitalism where more social concern has been built in, and many socialist countries have developed very much that part, but then have lost kind of democratic participation by the people and freedom and so on. So I don't have one accomplished example, but I think that's a kind of a goal of a vision. One more question?
Yeah. What is our responsibility then as a church to the state or to the government? Don't we have a responsibility to that?
Yes.
Portion? Maybe you could.
Yes. What is the responsibility of the church? Let me say that we will be talking more about that tomorrow and the day after tomorrow, about the responsibility of the church. But it is, anyhow, let me say this, some of you might not be here tomorrow. It is the task of the church raising these issues in the public. Or the church has a public role and cannot be restricted to the private sector and the private morality and so on, but has to raise these issues of the public order as a kind of a conscience of the whole of society.